Goal! Oops. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. Today, President Obama is promoting his plan to get more Americans overtime pay. We'll hear about a Canadian experiment to give everyone a minimum income, and I do mean give. Also, children adopted from Guatemala get help finding their birth mothers. It's not always easy.
You are going into, in many cases, a remote region. In many cases, the community is a closed community and they don't know about the relinquishment.
And soccer fans in England burn the midnight oil to see their women's team lose by an own goal.
So by the time the goal was scored, it was so late and I was so tired. There was a little part of me that was just thinking, just someone score.
Plus, a piano throwdown in Russia. Putin's a fan. That's all coming up today on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Coming up, the agony and sadness of defeat by your own foot. You may have even seen it. I'll explain later. But first, big news this week for folks like the manager of the Dunkin' Donuts across the street from our studio. We in the office see her every day, and she may benefit in a big way from President Barack Obama's plan to give some 5 million U.S. workers overtime pay. Mr. Obama is touring the country to promote it. We wanted to see how far some countries go with this idea. In the Dutch city of Utrecht, they're launching what's being called a daring new experiment: give poor citizens a basic income instead of welfare. Now, this is not unprecedented. One of the most famous experiments in basic income happened in Manitoba in Canada during the 1970s, in Dauphin and Winnipeg. Evelyn Forget is an economist and professor at the University of Manitoba.
Well, it was actually a follow-up on experiments that were conducted in the U.S. between about 1968 and 1980 to find out what would happen if you offered everybody a guaranteed income.
This was already happening in the U.S.?
It absolutely was.
Where?
Seattle, Denver, New Jersey, Appalachia. There were several sites.
What did Canada, what did Manitoba specifically see in the U.S. experiments that they thought, oh, that's a good idea, we should try that here?
I think everybody in North America at the time was recognizing that the way we were delivering social programs wasn't doing a very good job of eliminating persistent poverty. So in Canada, this was the same era that we introduced universal health insurance. We made more generous disability payments. And the guaranteed annual income, the income experiment, was part of that. I think when it was introduced, a lot of people believed it would be rolled out generally across the country by the end of the 70s.
So this program was called MINCOME, as in minimum income. What were critics saying when the program began?
People were very excited about it. People on the political right were excited by the prospect of less intrusion into people's lives and smaller government. It's administratively much simpler to run than a whole barrage of competing bureaucratic programs.
You know, I didn't do real well in economics in college, but if I were getting a minimum income, even if I were unemployed, I would probably say, why should I go to work?
Indeed, that was the reason all of these experiments were run in the first place. There was a fear that if you offered people a guaranteed income, people would reduce the number of hours they worked rather dramatically.
So what happened?
Well, what happened in Manitoba was the same thing that happened in all the U.S. experiments, and that is there was a reduction in the number of hours worked by around 9% or 10%, and that sounds like a lot. When we looked into the Dauphin sample in particular,
in Manitoba.
That's right. Yeah. We discovered that there were two groups of people who reduced the number of hours they worked, especially married women. When they left the workforce in order to give birth, they used the minimum income to buy themselves longer mat leaves.
Maternity,
So they stayed home with their infants for longer periods of time. But the group that really reacted by reducing the number of hours worked were young males, and in particular, teenage boys. When we interviewed people, we discovered that prior to the experiment, a lot of people from low-income families, a lot of boys in particular, were under a fair amount of family pressure to become self-supporting when they turned 16, leave school, at least pay your own way. When MINCOME came along, those families decided that they could afford to keep their sons in high school just a little bit longer. And one of the findings of the experiment was that there was a nice little increase in the high school completion rate during that period.
Yes, there's some positive results among those two groups that drew back their working hours. So you go back a few years later and interviewed some of those MNCOM participants. In the long run, what happened? What kind of stories did you hear?
We heard some really great stories. I guess one that was really affecting. I spoke to a woman who just retired from a long career as a librarian. And she told the story of being a single parent when this program was introduced. She was on welfare, but every time she went and asked for some job training, she was told to go home and take care of her kids and the system would take care of her. Mm. When MNCOM came along, she thought, well, I'm going to transfer from the welfare system to MNCOM and then I can do what I want with the money. She registered in a college training course and got a part-time job in a library. And over time, that became a full-time job. And eventually, she became head librarian. And when I spoke to her, she just retired. And she was extremely proud of both of her daughters completing college and becoming professionals. And she was very proud of having modeled for them a very different kind of a life.
So Utrecht in the Netherlands, it's in the initial phases of this experiment with basic income. Where else in the world, aside from the U.S. Years ago, have you seen this happen in a similar way?
I guess some of the most interesting experiments right now are taking place in low and middle income countries, in places like India and Malawi. People tend to call it something different now, unconditional cash transfers, but the impetus is very much the same. If you give people money with no strings attached, they pretty much spend it in ways you'd expect them to spend it. They send their kids to school, they buy better food for their families, they take their kids to the doctor and so on.
Evelyn Forget, economist and professor at the University of Manitoba. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Well, thank you.
The cost of living is also very much on the minds of people in the former Soviet Republic of Armenia. It's a tiny landlocked country of 3 million people, sandwiched between more powerful neighbors. You would not call Russia a neighbor exactly, but it has a huge influence on Armenia. For one thing, a Russian company owns Armenia's only electric utility. And for the past 10 days, thousands of young Armenians have been thronging the streets of the capital, Yerevan, to protest a planned hike in the cost of electricity. Babkin Dergrigorian is one of those protesters. I caught up with him this afternoon, just after he arrived back in London, where he's a student. So if you could, in 10 words or less, tell me what the protests are really about in Armenia right now.
The protests are really about a growing frustration with a lack of accountability and transparency within the Armenian government. So it's less about who is in power and more about making sure the institutions of the Armenian state are accountable to the population.
So how does that all translate when you're in the streets during these protests? It sounds like you're probably not saying, you know, down with the price of a kilowatt hour. What are the chants about?
No, the chants are the most popular chant would be we own this country. So that is something that has been said in this protest and in previous mobilizations as well. We own this country.
How have the government and the police been treating you out in the streets?
Well, the police initially tried to break up the protest and using excessive force. They opened a water cannon on us and they tried to repress the mobilization using really heavy-handed tactics. They ran after journalists, intentionally targeting journalists to break cameras. What happened next was that the following day, twice as many or 10 times as many people showed up, and it turned into people in the tens of thousands. So the police realized that that was not the best thing for them to do, and they have since stopped doing that.
Did you get hit with the water cannon?
I wasn't there that morning because I had to feed my dog that night.
You know people who did, though?
Yeah, plenty of people did. I was at the police station the morning of, and they were still bringing people in. They arrested 250 people, I believe was the final count, which is a really high number of arrests, given all the protests that have happened in the last few years.
So the government in Yerevan is pro-Moscow. You and other protesters out in the streets saying this is our country. Where is this all going? Do you plan to step up your demands?
The demands have stayed the same. The demands have not widened. They're very simple demands. We want the repeal of the fare hike. We want a review of the current fare, and we believe that the police that were involved in the excessive force need to be held to account. The thing with these demands is that just by having to address these demands, a number of other issues will have to come to, the government will have to address. So we don't think we need to, you know, widen the demands. Just these demands alone are, I think, valid. The government tried to appease the protesters by suggesting that they can subsidize the fare increase through the state budget. And I think that actually got people a little more upset and even a little insulted, because the budget is also filled by the citizens. And so that is not accepted as a solution to this. Either way, it comes out of the Armenian citizen's pocket. So why should the Armenian citizen have to pay for the mismanagement of a private Russian company? I think the bigger story in what is happening in Armenia is this awakening of the identity of the Armenian citizen and the rights and responsibilities that come with that identity.
Mm. I mean, Russia has shown its concern by saying these protests in Armenia could grow into a color revolution. Are you worried at all, Bobkin, that the government there might crack down hard, the government in Yerevan might crack down hard to head off anything like a color revolution?
This isn't a color revolution. And actually, a lot of people on the street were very insulted by the way the Russian media has been covering this. The fact that Russia can only see what happens in Armenia through this lens of a color revolution was really problematic for people, because this isn't the Maidan, this isn't the color revolution, this is Armenians trying to solve Armenia's problems.
Armenian protester Bobkin Dur-Grigoryan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
In soccer, they call an own goal a dagger through the heart. It's when you kick the ball into your own net. And that's exactly what England's Laura Bassett did yesterday. In the final seconds of the match against Japan, with the game tied 1-1, she kicked the ball into her own goal. It was an accident, of course, but it sent Japan to the final and Bassett to the ground in tears. Cynics call it a quintessential English soccer moment, and it's one my colleague at the BBC, Steve Crossman, watched with a tinge of guilt.
I have to admit something to kick us off here, Marco, and that is that here in the United Kingdom, I was watching the game and it kicked off our time at about midnight. So by the time the goal was scored, it was so late and I was so tired. There was a little part of me that was just thinking, just someone score, just no extra time. I need to go to bed. But there's no way that anyone would have wished what happened to Laura Bassett on any player. It doesn't matter what country you're from, what team you follow, because I guess she kind of knows. The bottom line is her career will be defined by that moment, and that's not fair on her, really, for what she's given to women's football and to the England national team.
Yeah, I mean, tragically, it was a beautiful lob, even though she tried to clear it from her own goal. Where does this rank in the pantheon of own goals, would you say?
Oh, God, that is a good question. The thing in Laura Bassett's defence is she had to do something. The ball had gone behind her. Her teammate Steph Houghton hadn't stepped up to play offside, so she had to try and get to the ball, and she could never have predicted in a million years what was going to happen. So it will be up there in the pantheon because it was so important. You know, the last minute of a World Cup semi-final, when England are in the World Cup semi-final for the first time ever. But in terms of the blame attached to it, I'd say it's low down.
Tell us a bit about Laura Bassett. This is, unfortunately, the first time many here have heard of her. Who is she as a player?
Yeah, and that just makes the point, doesn't it, Marco, that this is the moment which will define her career. But she's one of the generation that have come through when women's football wasn't popular at all in the United Kingdom, to the stage now where they're one of the few nations at the World Cup who back home, just like in America, have a professional league. So she's really seen women's football grow. She's played a big part in that. And Mark Sampson, the England coach, said something very, very nice about her after the game. He said, her legacy, much as we can say, will remember her for that moment. He says that there'll be some little girl watching that game in England who, in a couple of days' time, will say to their parents, I want to play football, I want to do what Laura Bassett did, and I don't want Steven Gerrard on the back of my shirt, I want the name Laura Bassett.
That's a great way to look at this. There was an infamous own goal some years ago in Colombia in 1994 that led to the killing of the player who committed that.
Andres Escobar, yeah.
Yeah, I doubt Laura Bassett will face bodily harm, but how do you think England's going to respond to this own goal? Will it depend on who comes in third now?
I don't think it will. I mean, I think going out of the tournament in this way is obviously heartbreaking. But if you've had a particularly good tournament, I wouldn't say it doesn't matter, but it certainly matters less. England have the opportunity in the third place playoff they face Germany. But I think even if they lose that game, there is nobody in the country who will view this tournament as anything else than a huge success. So I almost don't think they need to recover from it. But having said that, you know, if Laura Bassett particularly can play a part in an England team that beats Germany, and England love doing that, although they don't do it very often, then I think that will go some way to making up for what happened.
My BBC colleague Steve Crossman, here's to the Lionesses of England winning the bronze, Steve.
Cheers.
So it's Japan versus the US for the title rematch on Sunday. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I don't know if you knew this, but for a period of time, a lot of the babies adopted by Americans were born in Guatemala. In fact, from the late 1990s through 2008, millions of unregulated dollars flowed into a desperately poor country, and that raised a lot of red flags. The Guatemalan government stopped adoptions by Americans in 2008. Reporter Lori Stern adopted a boy from Guatemala before then, and she tells us that a new industry is popping up to unite adopted kids with their birth parents.
I love her. It feels right.
This is my 16-year-old son, Diego, and he's talking about his birth mother, Isabel. We see her in Guatemala every few years. We don't speak a common language. She speaks Tzotzil. We're lucky an English speaker lives in the village and helps us interpret. I recorded this on my phone last winter.
She's asking, are you working or are you going to school?
I go to school, but I'm not working yet.
When we get together, Isabel never takes her eyes off Diego. This last visit, she brought along Diego's 15-year-old birth sister. In the village, a lot of girls get married when they're 15.
What do you think if your sister also ever gets married? What are you going to say?
Good luck.
Buena suerte.
And I think she's very grateful for my adoptive parents for taking good care of me, you know, and helping raise me. And I think she also feels kind of sad because she knows that we may be together for a couple hours and then not see each other for a couple years.
Most adopted Guatemalans never have the chance to meet their birth mothers. For adoptive families that want to make the connection years later, there are people in Guatemala who will help for a fee. They're called searchers. Nancy Hoffman used to do searches. She's a travel agent and adoptive mom from Boston who has lived in Guatemala almost 20 years.
A search is a very delicate process. You are going into, in many cases, a remote region. In many cases, the community is a closed community and they don't know about the relinquishment, or the birth mother is in a different relationship.
Birth mothers may have secrets to protect. People who arranged adoptions may have skirted the law, and they don't want to be caught now.
It's very delicate, and in some ways it can be very dangerous for the searcher.
So Nancy left the searching business. Searching had been costing clients hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars, and Nancy couldn't be sure she was getting the truth. So now when Nancy's clients want to search, she puts them in touch with one of the few searchers she trusts, this woman, who has to be called Lolita.
Primeramente es decirle a la madre biológica.
Lolita says she loves her work because she gets to do two important things. First of all, she tells birth mothers their children are okay. She shows them photos and in some cases suggests a meeting. The second thing is that she gets to remind children where they came from, to tell them about their origins and the lives they could have had.
El lugar donde pudo haber hecho su vida.
A lot of first-time reunions take place at restaurants. Pollo Campero, like Guatemala's KFC, it's a favorite. Searchers say it's a comfortable place for birth mothers and adoptive families, and eating gives everyone something to do. A searcher we'll call Maria is ordering food at the Pollo Campero in Antigua. This meeting has already been tricky. 15-year-old Marta Howard is not sure she wants to be here. She lives in Maine now, adopted by a family there when she was 8. When she was 6, her birth mother placed her with a foster family.
Is it hard to look at her?
Yeah. I haven't seen her, I think, 8.5 years, so it's really hard.
Marta's birth mother sits at the head of the table, Marta at the other end. The searcher says Marta should get up and say hello, but Marta doesn't want to. Her parents beg the birth mother to make the first move. They say Marta feels rejected and confused. She's just a kid. They say she deserves an apology, or at least a kind word. The birth mother says she has nothing to apologize for. She had no money and many health problems, and it's clear to her that Marta is doing just fine. But Marta won't budge either.
I don't want to go over there. She can't make me do.
No.
Okay? I don't want to go over there, and that's fine. You said I can choose.
If I want to talk to you now,
then why are you forcing me?
I'm not.
Somehow, everyone manages to finish their fried chicken. After lunch, Marta even agrees to pose for pictures, as long as she doesn't have to stand next to her birth mother. The Howards give the birth mom a few hundred quetzales and walk her out. They say someday Marta will be glad she got to see her birth mom again. This was tough and unusual. 13-year-old Anna Kokonauer's experience was more typical.
I was just, like, really thrilled to meet them.
Anna was adopted when she was a baby. Her parents used a searcher to find her biological family a few years ago when she was 9. They agreed that last winter was the right time for her to meet them.
My siblings look a lot like me because I get these little curls on my head.
Anna noticed big differences, too.
It was sad because at the restaurant we went to for lunch, she couldn't read, so we had to help her.
Now Anna's parents are trying to figure out how to help the birth family over the long haul. That's common, too. Once the emotional connection is made, a financial arrangement often follows. For a fee, searchers will deliver Christmas baskets or make monthly visits or help send a sibling to school. It's not like there's a right way to do this. Lots of families are trying to figure it out, especially now that the adoption boom kids are becoming teenagers.
In the end, I'm gonna call myself Guatemalan. It's kind of helped me create a niche for where I'm at and how I define myself.
We met our son's birth mother, Isabel, back when we adopted him. So we never used a searcher, but we understand why people would want to.
You know, if I didn't meet her, you know, I wouldn't have a connection. I mean, I could say, I'm originally from Guatemala, but I wouldn't know what I was talking about, and I do now.
For The World, I'm Laurie Stern.
American families adopt kids from all over the world, and at PRI.org we've posted an interactive map showing where the children come from. And while you're there, you can watch a video of Diego meeting his birth mother for the first time. Again, that's at PRI.org. Whether it's charcoal or gas or an open wood fire, this weekend a lot of us are going to load up on fuel to start the 4th of July grilling, because nothing says revolution better than a piece of meat on an open flame, right? Seriously, we'll be talking grilling traditions and grilled food around the globe tomorrow on The World, including chicken yakitori. In Japan, it's about grilling more than just a chicken breast.
There are so many other parts of the animal that they grill in Japan. I mean, they grill the tail and the beak and the skin and the intestines. I mean, you can get really crazy funky on the offal, but I love the chicken thighs. They're just so juicy and moist.
Our grill goes global with our friend and food critic Steve Dolinsky. That's tomorrow. And you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Afghanistan, 4 men involved in the brutal killing of a young woman have had their death sentences overturned. An Afghan women's rights campaigner says on one hand, she's not surprised, and on the other...
Of course, in another way, it is shocking because this is the consequences of the absence of rule of law.
Plus, breakdancing for peace on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Mandarin, mobile app development, and mindfulness. Curious.com. Grow your skills at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Farhunda Malikzada was a young Afghan woman living in Kabul. In March, she got into an argument with a mullah of a shrine who falsely accused her of burning pages from the Quran. Farhunda was grabbed by a mob of men who overheard the argument. I'm going to tell you what they did, but it's horrible. They stoned her to death, ran over her body with a car, and then set it on fire. The story caused outrage in Afghanistan and around the world. An Afghan court sentenced some of her killers to death, but today 4 of those death sentences were unexpectedly overturned in a closed court hearing. Orzala Ashraf Nemat is an Afghan women's rights activist based in London. Ms. Nemat, were you surprised by this change in the sentence?
Of course, it's very disappointing. Of course, it is. It's shocking to see that with such level of evidence being available on the actual killing, photos and footages, and, you know, all the stories that came out, suddenly see that the punishment is reduced. So it's not surprising. We knew the people who are directly involved in the actual acts of violence, they had networks and supports within the government, within the power networks in the country. And of course, in another way, it is shocking because this is the consequences of the absence of rule of law.
Mm. And you believe the accused wanted to get away with it and that they had connections within the government that made it possible for those judges to clear the sentence?
So when you have a society or a country in which you have people who are powerful and their power goes beyond the government and state institutions, this is what happens. I'm not saying that the judiciary system were directly bribed, but there are different ways that corruption operates in such systems. Maybe they are not directly bribed by being paid money or any kind of, you know, goods and items, but maybe they are threatened because when there were public hearings, some politicians showed up in the courtroom with their armed bodyguards. So why would somebody bring their armed bodyguards inside a courtroom? It's to show that we are powerful and that we have guns and weapons and personal private bodyguards and can do anything.
Is this court decision irreversible? I mean, who would appeal it on behalf of Farhunda Malikzadeh?
Well, it's not irreversible in a sense that there is a very tiny bit of an opportunity at the Supreme Court level. Supreme Court has a council, and we recently had an appointed female member in that council, which is very first and new in the Afghan Supreme Court. So there is a tiny bit of hope that at least at the Supreme Court level, this decision is changed. But this is a big challenge in front of President Ghani to prove to the world and to the Afghan people that he is caring about the life of Afghan women and the Afghan people, and that he is different from President Karzai when it comes to impunity and ending that culture of impunity.
Ms. Nemat, you just got back yesterday from Afghanistan. Do you feel like the public spaces in Kabul anyway are getting to be safer for women?
Well, unfortunately, not really. I mean, I was back in Kabul for the last 1.5 months, and to be honest and frank, I mean, I myself, I'm a kind of person that I like walking and I like going to the shops and markets on my own. And after Farhunda incident, I really didn't feel confident or comfortable going anywhere, walking anywhere in public on my own, the way that I was doing it before. And unfortunately, in Afghanistan, this is like one additional insecurity that has been added. Because generally, I mean, I skipped several number of, you know, suicide attacks and bombings by few minutes, being lucky and not being there in the time it happened, but being just away from it like few hundred meters, you know, several times. But what Farhunda's case have added to that is this sense of not feeling secure from people who are just next to you. And these people, you can imagine that they can suddenly, you know, turn against you and just be as violent as you can probably not even imagine. A woman or girl in a public space feels less safer and secure than a boy in a man.
Ms. Nemat, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Orzala Ashraf Nemat, an Afghan women's rights activist based in London. Things are pretty insecure as well these days in Tunisia, whether you're a woman or a man. The most obvious example is the attack a week ago at a beachfront resort where a gunman massacred 38 tourists. Police there say they've arrested 8 people and claim security services have been able to uncover and destroy the network behind the operation. But one group of young people wonder if Tunisia will ever really destroy the terror networks. They're breakdancers with a troupe designed, in part, to counter the attraction of Islamic radicals. Marine Olivezi revisits the Rocking Steps crew in Sidi Bouzid.
In a low-budget video, a young man spins, flips, and slides. It's probably become the most viral breakdancing clip to ever come out of Tunisia, for the wrong reasons. Ilyes, 18, cracks a joke. He's a poor dancer, he says, but a skilled terrorist. Seyfeddin Rezgi, the teenager on the 2010 video, shot dead 38 tourists on a beach last week, the worst attack in Tunisia's history.
How are you?
Hello. Hey, a long time.
Over a year ago, I came to Sidi Bouzid, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, to report on this joyful bunch of b-boys. But the Rocking Steps crew's talents extended well beyond the dance floor. They were touring the country, organizing workshops in small towns and villages. The group was supported by USAID at the time. Wissam Misawi, their project supervisor, told me their efforts were invaluable in the fight against extremism.
The youth problem, especially in the interior of the country, it's like they don't feel belong to anything. They don't feel belong to this society. They feel marginalized. And that's why they are like easy attracted by the extremist group and by the violence group and by the criminals.
It's hard to tell how committed Rezgi was to breakdance 5 years ago. But whatever happened next in his life makes one thing clear. His love for breakdance didn't stop him from turning terrorist. I ask the b-boys of Sidi Bouzid what they make of him, a seemingly westernized dude who opens fire at Western tourists sunbathing. And the thing is, they aren't that shocked. Nidal Boulaghi has trained up to 250 dancers across the country over the past years. After the revolution, extremists were on the rise in this mostly secular country. Nidal saw firsthand the cultural clash play out, and he saw the radical groups win over several of his friends.
Breakdancers, artists, and musicians were all prime targets for radicals.
Vous êtes pas musulmans, vous avez pas un Dieu.
They keep telling us that we're not Muslims, that we have no God. And the minute a dancer gets into trouble because he's broke, for example, they use that to take him away from dance. These extremists, they offer you money, they offer you a job. At first they're like, you know, just come and pray at the mosque. They tell you it's okay to dance as long as you're praying. Then later on they tell you you should stop listening to the music because it's the music of infidels. You know, I have a friend who was training without music for a while, then he just stopped dancing.
It could well be Seyfeddin Rezgi's story, too. He came from a working-class family and moved away from his tiny hometown to continue his studies. Local reports have said the Islamic group he socialized with at university was paying his rent, so it's not a stretch to imagine he was lured in the same way. Nidal can only guess, but one thing he knows as a breakdancer, and a successful one, is that the lack of support here for the arts is overwhelming. You go from frustration to more frustration, he says, until you reach a breaking point.
When I hit a wall, I stay calm. I try to figure out something else, even if I see dream after dream being shattered. Others might be weaker. I see friends posting stuff on Facebook about ISIS all the time, celebrating them. They don't necessarily do it because they embrace their ideas. It's more like cursing at the system.
That rage against society will go on as long as young people feel the deck is stacked against them, says Nidal. Joining ISIS just seems like a better way to play out anger than breakdancing these days, because everybody's scared of ISIS. Now, though, Nidal is worried everybody will be scared of breakdancers, too.
Before, I was proud to be a dancer. Now I'm wondering if he did that, maybe another breakdancer will do the same. It's scary to see that dancers, extremists, terrorists, they all look the same now. One friend of mine, who's a cop, told me right after the attack, he looked just like you. Same hair, same clothes. As breakdancers, we used to stand out. What are we going to do now?
So it's now almost 2 in the morning, and there are a dozen guys breakdancing in the hallways of an outdoor shopping center. Obviously, everything is closed. They've got the place for themselves, and that's pretty much the only place where they can practice. So they come here and train at 2 a.m. The music comes from a cell phone. Their footwork performed on a dirty floor. The routine they're doing now made them finalists this year in the prestigious Red Bull's annual breakdance competition, a rare showcase of their talents. Nidal says there used to be 12 big events a year right after the revolution. Now the funding has dried up and only 2 remain. He was invited to perform in France this month, but couldn't get a visa. Yet another blow to his dreams. I'm not sure how long we'll keep going, he says. We train and train, but without a dance school and more shows, it just seems pointless. It's like spinning in a vacuum. For the world, I'm Marine Olivesi in Sidi Bouzid, Tunisia.
When you think of breakdancing, New York City likely comes to mind, but after you see these guys do their thing, Tunisia might just change your thinking. Marine shot a great video of these b-boys. You can watch it at PRI.org. So when you make something illegal, generally the law of supply and demand kicks in, and an underground or black market pops up. That's what happened with Iran. Around 6 years ago, the U.S. and other countries imposed crippling sanctions on the Islamic Republic due to its nuclear program, ushering in a period of national deprivation. But in the end, Iran was able to get some of what it needed through that black market I mentioned. Reporter Colm Lynch wrote about this for Foreign Policy.
One of the things that they have done is that as some of the markets have closed in places like, you know, Germany and Europe, they have been forced to move to other parts of the world, buying stuff in China, Malaysia, other European markets. But it's also like a lot of these cases, it's always a sort of game of cat and mouse where the West and the Security Council will devise ways to sort of block the sort of transfer of some of these goods, and the Iranians will find other ways to do it.
Was any of the material that the smuggling network brought into Iran, was any of it actual like nuclear radioactive material like plutonium?
No. I mean, what they have been doing is designing, you know, reactors that could produce low-enriched uranium. But also they have designed what's called the Iraq sort of nuclear reactor, which had the initial capabilities of producing plutonium. Part of the New Deal includes a provision that would force them to kind of remove the core of that reactor and to replace it with a more benign reactor that won't have the capacity to develop weapons-grade plutonium.
I mean, the goal of the economic sanctions was to stop Iran from getting a lot of stuff, including materials like these, maybe especially materials like these. What does that say about the strength of the sanctions?
Well, I guess it depends how you look at it. I mean, defenders of the system would say you can't imagine what it would be like if we didn't have this system in place. And there are lots of cases where the Iranians get caught porting this stuff in the Gulf, in other ports where, you'll see stories in the news about, somebody, the authorities in Singapore picking up sort of evidence that an Iranian ship has come through and it's carrying some sort of industrial product that can be used for the nuclear program. So there has been a lot of exposure of the kinds of smuggling operations that the Iranians have been involved in. And so the experts who follow this think that they could have been far more advanced in the program and they could have produced nuclear materials and enriched uranium at a much faster rate than we've seen.
If an underground network of smugglers in Iran was able to get the hardware needed for nuclear research, does that mean that a lot of things have gotten through, like DVDs and cars and food items?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's hard. Like, if you look at, every once in a while, you will see, the UN has a panel that sort of examines and monitors this sort of thing. And you would see it less so in Iran, but like in North Korea, where there is also a ban on luxury goods, which I don't think there is on Iran. So you would see like a massive shipment of ballet shoes or Mercedes Benzes or kind of yachts and things like that. You don't see that same issue involving Iran. But, what you see and what they're really focused is on the nuclear stuff, but also on conventional weapons.
Meantime, they seem to be closing in on a deal in Vienna, but there is this underground network. Won't that have to be dismantled as part of any deal that they come up with in Vienna? And how hard is that going to be?
I don't know that the focus would be trying to dismantle it. I mean, what they would want to do, I mean, I think one of the things that, I mean, I talk about in this article I wrote is how do you devise a system to stop this? And so, there have been, some experts who say what you need is you need a system that focuses on a small number of very highly sensitive materials, kind of high strength aluminum, carbon fiber, things like miraging steel, all the stuff that, people who are focused on this issue see as extremely sensitive. And if you have it narrowly focused, that you could have a better chance of stopping it from coming into the country. If you have sufficient controls over the nuclear facilities, even if stuff gets into the country, that it can't be used because you know where they're doing all the nuclear work.
Foreign Policy's Colm Lynch, always great to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thanks for having me, Marco.
A classical music smackdown in Moscow up next here on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, and this is what I call From Russia with Love and 88 Keys. Every 4 years, some of the greatest young classical musicians gather in Moscow for the International Tchaikovsky Competition. It started in the Soviet Union in 1958. It was the height of the Cold War, and famously, the first winner was an American, Van Cliburn. Back then, the competition was a quiet affair. This year, it was almost a reality show, televised around the globe live and in high def, millions tuning in, and many viewers took to social media to rate the performances. Even Vladimir Putin took part, speaking at today's gala concert featuring the winners of the competition. Here to talk about the International Tchaikovsky Competition is our colleague from down the hall, Kathy Fuller, midday host at WGBH's Classical Station. Kathy, before we get to the winners, when we talk about this competition, we gotta say, it is really Russian, isn't it?
That's for sure, yeah. And you know, the Russian school, as they call it, is a whole way of thinking about how to train a young person, a child, and immerse them into the world of piano playing. And while there isn't really a Russian way of playing, the Russian culture and the Russian school has been such a part of Russia for so long that it makes good sense that they would give birth to a competition like this.
Does this get a lot of attention in Moscow? Do a lot of people follow what's going on with the competition?
Oh, yes. I think there are those who live really for the competition, as they do in Texas for the Van Cliburn competition. And one of the things about competition, it's kind of a contradiction in terms. We love personalities. It's a parade. And we're talking about 10 million views now, thanks to Medici TV. And I think it's important to keep it in your pocket, not to forget that really the greatest artists who are playing the greatest music are the artists who disappear, just like a great Hamlet disappears. He becomes Hamlet. Well, the great young artist needs to become Beethoven or Tchaikovsky in a very big way.
Well, let's illustrate that with some examples from this year's competition. The first prize in piano went to a Russian, Dmitry Maslyeyev, and this is from one of his performances. Can you name this work when I ask?
Yeah, this is the sonata called Les Adieux, The Farewells. Very unusual for Beethoven. The players had to play a sonata from the classical period, including Beethoven. And this is the one that he chose.
Yeah, so what are the judges listening for in this piece of Beethoven? You talk about the performer disappearing into the work of Beethoven.
Well, in this case, here's Beethoven, joyous and full of a kind of almost giddy gleefulness at the end of the piece. All of that needs to come through. The emotions of the work need to come through. Now, there are many ways. You could be a pianist and decide that something is sad and sentimental, and you could play it in a kind of cozy, sad way that feels plush and wonderful. Another pianist could come along, play the same music, and it's no longer sad and sentimental and plush. It's suddenly hollow and empty and kind of devastating. That's two people playing the same music, but in a different way.
Who are the judges? Are they mostly Russian?
5 out of the 12 in this year's competition are actually Russian. And actually, the man who for, I think, about 20 years was in charge of the Van Cliburn competition has come over to the Tchaikovsky competition to sort of, as they say, clean it up. Because it's been stained a little bit.
And is he American?
Yes, Richard Rodzinski. And he's decided, no, we can't have teachers doing this anymore, because there have been a lot of rumors and a lot of problems with teachers sort of bending the rules. Perhaps he wants great players making good decisions about young people who will go on to sort of communicate great messages.
So George Lee, a 19-year-old pianist from Boston, tied for second place. Let's hear him a little from his performance of Beethoven's Sonata 32 in C minor, Opus 111. Thank you.
and one of the most difficult, far-reaching, modern pieces that Beethoven ever put to paper.
And how did he do?
He did it beautifully. Poetic, full spectrum, I like to say. He goes from the very softest to the very fullest kind of sound in an intelligent way.
So it's becoming much more, as you say, an international competition. But are there still kind of discernible national styles that pop out during the Tchaikovsky competition?
Well, I think that's happening less and less. It's a really good question, you know. I once asked a Russian pianist who was in our studio, so can you tell when it's a Russian pianist when you hear one? He says, oh, unfortunately, yes, I can. I think there's a kind of strength inherent in the Russian style of playing. Russians are strong of character. They are strong of sort of id. They have strong personalities. And they are encouraged to bring their personality to bear in a piece. That isn't always the best way to go. They're also very strong-fingered, strong technique. But it's melting. The world is melting, as you know. Mm. The world is becoming a kind of one place in many ways. It's a vastly different world than it used to be.
So how tied is the Tchaikovsky competition to just the hyper-nationalism that's been kind of pushed by Vladimir Putin over the last few years?
That's very hard to say. And I think if I went in any direction on that, I'd probably be wrong or right. I think it shouldn't be. I think the only thing that a competition should represent is the importance of the artist in a society. What happened when Van Cliburn won was amazing. It was the height of the Cold War. He fell in love with the Russians. The Russians fell in love with him. He was like an olive branch at that point. But that isn't the reason you have a competition. The reason that you have a competition is to find someone who can communicate beyond nationalism and directly into the hearts and the imaginations of the people. And that's not easy to find.
Well, Kathy Fuller, let's end with one of the performances that earned Dmitry Maslyayev first prize at the International Tchaikovsky Competition. This is Sergei Prokofiev's Piano Concerto 3 in C Major, Opus 26. Kathy Fuller is host of WGBH's Classics in the Morning. Kathy, great of you to be here. Thank
you. Marco, so nice to see you. Thanks.
I'm Marco Werman, and that is it for The World Today. I'll be back tomorrow here in the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. Thank you for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, and the Billy and Dodie Crockett Advised Fund of the Dallas Foundation. By the Ford Foundation, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. By the Annenberg Foundation, Advancing a Better Tomorrow Through Visionary Leadership Today, annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.